This is The Blade and Beyond with the DC Dynamic Duo. Learn every detail about life on both ends of the knife. And now, live from Washington, D.C., your hosts, board-certified facial plastic surgeon, Dr. Michael Salmanik, and board-certified plastic surgeon, Dr. Troy Pittman.
Okay, everybody, here we are. We are back. It is Sunday, February 19th. Welcome to The Blade and Beyond. I'm Dr. Troy Pittman.
And I'm Dr. Michael Salmanik. And yes, it is middle of February, and it feels like it's middle of April.
It's 65 degrees outside.
It's ridiculous. This weather is, I don't know, I guess global warming?
It's something. I mean, we haven't really had any winter in Washington. It snowed one time, and we were out of town when it snowed.
Barely, for like 2 hours, and it melted within like 30 minutes.
Seriously. So a lot of you have been writing in asking, where are you guys? Where have you been? It's been probably 6 weeks since we put out our last episode. And
Flies. I mean, we've been traveling. That's what it comes down to. We've had some international things. I went to Paris, where you met me after a couple of days, where I was at the IMCAS conference, one of my favorite conferences to speak at. And we took a little trip to Paris and then London, celebrating your mother's 70th birthday.
Yeah, so we brought my mom out of the country at the age of 70 for the first time ever. And she'd never been to a place where people didn't speak English.
Yeah, it was an interesting trip. Very enlightening on all levels.
Cultural immersion, I'll tell you. But we had a great time. We had good dinners. And we saw the Tina Turner musical in...
I thought it was okay.
It was... the woman who played Tina Turner...
She was
phenomenal. Worth the cost of admission.
The storyline was a little slow and snoozy to me.
Well, the storyline is the storyline.
Well, I felt like her childhood... Yes, I
there could have been less childhood, although I don't think I could have taken one more minute of watching domestic violence. It's heavy.
Well, that was her life as well.
I know.
So you can't discount that either.
Yeah, that's true. So anyway, that's what we've been doing. Our first topic today is a little bit of a hot topic. And
dun, dun, dun.
Well, you know, it is the Ozempic craze. And so we've had news articles talking about the Ozempic face, which is basically people losing weight and changes that happen in the face. But this is my segment, so we're not talking
about
the face.
But it's getting strange media attention.
It is.
Don't you think it's weird that numerous articles are being written just about Ozempic face?
Well, I mean, I think that this Ozempic craze is exactly that. It's a craze. And I have real concern about the semaglutide drugs.
Well, can you first explain, because I'm sure everyone knows somebody that's on it or is on it, what does it do?
So semaglutide is a glucagon-like peptide inhibitor.
Well, what's
so
glucagon?
GLP-1. And so what it does is it causes the pancreas to produce insulin, which is the hormone that lowers our glucose levels. But along with that...
Your blood sugar.
It lowers the blood sugar. So along with that, it also tells the brain that... It mimics the hormone that tells the brain that you're full. And it also decreases gastric emptying. And so...
makes you feel full even if you're not.
It makes you feel full. It decreases cravings and whatnot. But the issue that I have with the drug is, A, it's really, Ozempic itself is FDA approved only for type 2 diabetes. It's not approved for weight loss.
Just in the U.S.?
Just in the U.S.
I think, remember when I was in Australia, I told you, I came back and people were like, they were using it exclusively as a weight loss drug almost, but I don't think they have FDA type of things.
Well, they have a regulatory agency. You know, Australia was the first country to have a major shortage for Ozempic, and now we're seeing that in the United States. So not to get off topic, but I think also there are people who have type 2 diabetes who are dependent on this drug, and they're now not able to get the drug. So we're going to just put that aside. But,
yeah.
You know, my big issue with this drug is that if you look historically of all of these magic bullet weight loss drugs, there's always been a side effect that has basically shut it down. So when we look at fen-phen, the
cardiac complications.
So everybody was excited about fenfluramine and fenfluramine, and it turned out that fenfluramine could cause valvular heart defects. And so that was pulled off the market. My big concern, and I have patients now all the time in the office who are saying, oh, should I go to my neighborhood, the hormone replacement person who's now prescribing Ozempic? Should I get on Ozempic?
That's the craziest thing to me, that people are, they're basically using this as like a cosmetic treatment. You go to the office once a week and they charge you to inject Ozempic.
Well, they're calling it the skinny pen. So it's a once a month injection, and they're calling it the skinny pen. But the issue with this is several things. First of all, there's the shortage. So that's an issue. But my big concern with this drug is they do know, when they did the studies for type 2 diabetes, that it increases the size and the activity of the islet cells, which are the cells in the pancreas that actually produce insulin.
Right.
And so my concern is you're causing an exogenous, meaning not internal, your own body's not producing this. You're giving the pancreas medicine to cause it to become overactive and to cause the cells to get larger. And we know just in basic science that whenever you cause an upregulation of cells and cells start doing what they're not supposed to do at a rapid, in a rapid fashion, you can get hyperplasia, which is overgrowth of the cell, which leads to metaplasia, which is a mutation of the cell, and then that can lead to a malignancy.
But these are all assumptions you're making.
I'm making an assumption.
Yeah.
But my concern as someone, if I was going to take that drug, my concern is one of the side effects of all of the semaglutide drugs is pancreatitis. So we know that it can cause pancreatic inflammation. And so that in itself can lead to problems. But, you know, how do we know that in 10 years, all of these patients who are taking this medicine, which is causing their pancreas to be overactive, those people aren't going to develop some type of pancreatic malignancy or pancreatic cancer?
I mean, I don't think we know that just because of the limited data and lack of clinical trials, but not lack of long-term clinical trial follow-up, I should say.
So my other issue, though...
But wait... There's a ton of people that are on it that just like how many people do we know that are looking to just like drop 5 or 10 pounds that are getting on this drug?
And that is really where the flawed logic comes in. So what we do have pretty good data now, you know, people have been on this drug for a couple of years. There is a rebound effect. So when you stop taking the drug, you rebound, you gain your weight back, the cravings come back with a vengeance. There was just a story that recently came out. It chronicled 3 women who were on Ozempic, and they needed to go off of the drug for various reasons, and they said their cravings immediately came back. Once they got off of it, they gained their weight back and then some. And so this,
like, we see that with all these weight loss drugs. They're on it, they're great, and then they get off of it, and then they rebound.
Well, I mean, and I think that what's being kind of advertised when you look at internet things, the skinny pen, which they're calling it, is, okay, I'm going to be on this drug, I'm going to lose 10 pounds, and then I'm going to behave myself, and I'm just going to be able to keep those 10 pounds off. But you're physiologically altering your body with the drug. And so as soon as you're off the drug, your metabolism, if you have the same behavior, your metabolism goes back to your metabolism. If you're someone who weighs, you know, who is 150 pounds overweight, obviously taking a medication like this
is beneficial for you.
But you're committing yourself to being on this drug forever.
Well, unless you incorporate lifestyle changes, which is what any dietitian... a diet doctor would tell you, that it's not just the shot that's going to keep the weight off. It is a lifestyle modification.
Right. And you know, the biggest issue, we have several friends who are not obese, who have taken the drug. One of our friends had said that he had intractable nausea.
Yeah, he was just like nauseous all the time.
All the time.
So he lost weight.
And he would start to feel like he was going to throw up. And so he would eat a gummy bear. And when he ate a gummy bear, he started to feel better. So that's flawed logic, right? I'm on an appetite suppressant drug that makes me nauseated, but if I eat candy, I feel better.
It just doesn't sound healthy.
And then we have another friend who probably doesn't need to lose any weight. He just wants to be a little bit more svelte.
But he did lose weight on it.
I'm talking about the other guy.
Oh, we have multiple
people. The other guy who I'm mouthing his name to you, but he doesn't need to lose any weight and he's about to go on the drug. And we've told him, don't go on this drug. You know, it is problematic. And I think that really we know what the magic bullet is for weight loss. It is.
We've known for years and decades and centuries.
Yes, it's calorie reduction. You can trick your metabolism for only so long, but it is really lifestyle modification, diet, and exercise.
Yes.
So that is the quick and dirty. If anyone would like to yell at me about my views on Ozempic, please feel free to DM me. I'd love to hear what you have to say. But I can tell you that we are seeing things. You don't want to take any drug that's causing you to have intractable nausea. The body is not meant to be nauseated.
Right. I'm confused by that anyway, but at the same time, it does not seem normal. And it's not just one or two people. It's like almost everyone that we know that is on it has like some element of like nausea that they feel with it, which is, that's the worst feeling to feel.
Right. Or they have headaches or they have fatigue. I mean, I still stand by in history. We're going back to when Maria Callas, the opera singer, she ate a tapeworm in order to lose weight. There's been no drug or tapeworm or anything that helps people lose weight and keep weight off.
And that still is an option today. But okay, anything else to add about your Ozempic soapbox?
I think that I'm off. I'm ready to be off my soapbox.
Okay, well, thank you for sharing that with us. I'm going to jump to...
In the news.
Okay.
All right. We have a couple things to discuss today. One is fairly short, but I thought was really interesting. This is something that is not being reported by many people, but the Consumer Action for a Strong Economy, their acronym is CASE, they sent a letter to the FDA this past week regarding false claims of Daxxify, which is the new neuromodulator that has been approved by the FDA that allegedly was shown in studies to last up to 6 months, if not a little bit longer, in some of their subjects that they followed.
So this is an injectable that is...
It's like a Botox competitor.
It's supposed to last longer than Botox or Dysport or Xeomin or Evolus.
Yeah, so they sent a letter to the FDA alerting them to false claims made by Revance, who's the company that produces the toxin. And they claim that Revance is stating that Daxxify benefits last 50% longer than extensive FDA testing of the product concluded. Now, this is almost like a press release on their site, so I don't know anything more about it, but I did find it interesting that there's already some, I guess, higher organizations or bodies that are potentially contesting the claims of this before it really full on hits the market. That's a problem.
Well, we don't know where this complaint came from, do we?
No, we don't. It's just from this regulatory body. So I don't know.
Okay. I mean, I think that, you know, the issue with any of these medications, with saying, okay, this medication is going to last XXX, is that it's a drug and any drug is variable. And so I'm getting so distracted because the dogs are running around the room like crazy. I don't know if you can hear them barking and growling, but...
I know, just ignore them. We're still going to continue.
So, sorry. This is a drug. And the drug is going to be metabolized by each individual differently. And so when we look at Botox, we look at Dysport, we know on average it's about 3 months before it needs to be redosed. And so my concern with any of these drugs where they say, okay, this is going to last 9 months, Patient comes into the office and we say, okay, this could last up to 6 to 9 months. What do you do when you've charged the patient a higher price point and the patient comes in at 3 months and says, my forehead is completely moving, my crow's feet are back, and it's only been 3 months, and you sold this to me at a higher price point and you told me it was going to last 6 months? How is that not causing a problem?
Here's the deal. This is how it's going to happen, and this is how I'm going to present it to people, because we are going to be carrying it at some point once it's released this quarter. We're probably going to be one of the few practices, I think, in the next month or two that is going to be able to carry it. But it's just going to come down to full transparency. There are some people that are very interested in this product. They want the potential for something to last longer, knowing that it may not last as long. So you do go into it knowing that there's a study behind it that shows that on average, it does last longer. So the chance of it lasting longer in you as the patient getting injected is a pretty good chance. How much longer, we don't know. Are you willing to pay for that? That's up to you.
And I think that's an interesting question. So for those of you that are listening, please DM us, send us a message, because I'd be interested to know how many of you would be willing to pay more for something that potentially would last longer. It's something that we haven't really talked to our patients about a lot, but I'd really be interested to hear your thoughts. So send us a message.
Yeah, I have a handful of patients that are willing to do that. They like the idea of it. And so we will see as it becomes more widespread, as it becomes injected more. I think we're going to get some longer term follow-up with this.
Okay, what's up next?
All right, the other thing is not so uplifting, but I wanted to talk about it. Bruce Willis was in the news this week, who we kind of knew that he had aphasia, which is kind of, you start progressively losing the ability to speak. That's what aphasia is. He has frontotemporal dementia, which is quite a frightening diagnosis.
Which is really, the frontotemporal region is the part of the brain which controls communication and
executive functioning, language, skills, all those things. So the symptoms of advanced disease include severe obsession, agitation, and disinhibited behavior. So sometimes I think that I actually have this on some weeks. But the because it also affects a younger population.
40 to 60.
45 to 60. You were close. But it also accounts for 10 to 20% of dementia cases. Some are inherited. Most are just bad luck, which I think is very scary. It usually progresses slowly. But as we've seen with Bruce Willis, I mean, we heard this maybe a year and a half, 2 years
ago. Well, we haven't seen anything of Bruce Willis. This is really all being reported by his family.
No, but remember, they came out with this a couple of years, maybe like a year and a half ago, that, oh, he has this aphasia. Then it kind of went away. Not that it went away, but we just didn't hear anything about it. And now they're like trying to raise awareness, because I think he's progressing quickly, which is atypical for this disease.
Well, you know, and that's, I was reading that the prognosis of the disease can be 6 to 8 years from diagnosis to actual death.
And there's no cure.
Which is really strange when you think about how does dementia end up killing you?
I just think that you just forget to do things.
Well, I think you become debilitated.
You do become debilitated. You stop.
Your respiratory function is altered. You can aspirate.
Because one of the, I mean, there's therapies that can help, like speech therapy, et cetera, but there's no like pill to take. There's no cure for it.
Right.
So it is a terminal illness, which is just one of those other looped in things that's just very scary to get if you're diagnosed with it. And there's no real prevention. It's not like, oh, do crossword puzzles, like for Alzheimer's and that. Although it can be confused with it sometimes.
And I do think that crossword puzzles, just to refute that, crossword puzzles actually test your ability to know words that you already know. And to really help with dementia and Alzheimer's, you need to learn new words. So crossword puzzles, that's actually urban myth. Just a little aside.
I would actually disagree with you, because a lot of the times...
Oh, are you a neurologist now?
No, but you discover words when you do crosswords.
But they're words that you already know. You're not just learning a new word.
No, sometimes you actually learn a new word doing a crossword.
You're getting that confused.
Automatically filling in.
You're getting... No, you're getting that confused with how you make up words on Scrabble, and sometimes you get lucky.
No.
So anyway, it's interesting, though, with frontotemporal dementia. One of the scientists that's really at the forefront of the studies, she said this is not an incurable disease. It is an underfunded disease, which I think is a big statement. And I do think we put a lot of money toward a lot of scientific research, and dementia really is pretty underfunded.
Mm-hmm. I know, especially with the incidence of it. This is one form of it, though, just to be clear.
Okay, so moving on, are we doing more into the news, in the news, or are we going to move on to
Into
face?
The news. It's called In the News. You're thinking of your musicals, Into the Woods. This is In the News. No, and In the News is wrapping up, and we're going to now go into neck sculpting. So this is sort of a big topic. We get a lot of terminology on social media, on websites, everywhere about ways to like sculpt the neck. Like, okay, for instance, there is the deep plane facelift. People are like, what is that? What does that do? And then there's what I consider deep neck sculpting, which is a little bit different. So I'm going to break it down for you, because there's many ways to address the neck depending on what it looks like, what the anatomy is, etc. So I'm going to start with the most simple. Submental liposuction. Someone's got a little bit of fat that's in their neck. They're looking to improve the contour. They have good skin tone. They're in their 20s, 30s, 40s, maybe early 40s with good skin tone. Submental lipo works beautifully.
But you're only removing the fat on the outside of the muscle.
That's right. So, yes.
And you're not doing anything to the skin.
You are not doing anything to the skin. And you're just removing the fat. A lot of the times that skin contracts beautifully. You get a nice contour. You go about your day. Voila. Okay. Submental lipo. That's that. So there's something called the platysma in the neck. And that's a muscle that we all have. It basically covers the entire neck region. As we age, it separates. You start getting the banding. And as your skin becomes more lax, it starts to sag a little bit. And you start seeing those like edges of the muscle hanging in the middle of your neck. So below the muscle, a lot of the time, and not just in older people, in many young people, they have a big fat pad underneath the platysma. And submental liposuction doesn't address that.
So here's a little trick that you can all do in your car as you're driving.
Don't crash.
If you stick your tongue to the roof of your mouth and you grab the fat underneath your chin, if you still can squeeze a lot of that fat, then you have a lot of extra platysma fat. And submental lipo is good. If you put the tongue, your tongue on the roof of your mouth, and your fat pad disappears, then you have more subplatysmal fat.
Okay, so that's where deep neck sculpting comes into play.
This is like the pencil under the breast trick. You can try it at home.
Kind of. But there's that population that they want that sort of snatch neck. And then I examine them and I feel that there's more fat below the muscle than there really is above. And I just tell them submental lipo will give you an improvement, but it's not going to give you the full deal. Mm-hmm. So what I do is I make that tiny incision underneath the chin. Same thing, like it's basically a centimeter and a half to 2 centimeters. It's nothing. It's right under the cleft of the chin. It hides well. I go under the muscle and I remove that fat pad, which ultimately allows the muscle, the skin to contract beautifully.
Is there anything under that muscle?
There's more muscle. There's more muscle, but.
And do you take out the muscle?
The muscle, the central muscle, no. But there's another little muscle that in some people, it creates a little fullness on the side, which I reduce the size of it. Usually in the younger population, I don't. When I'm doing neck lifts on somebody, I frequently do. But the deep neck sculpting can be transformative for what it can do for someone, again, with reasonable skin tone that has that fat compartment that just needs to be removed. I did this on a gentleman about 3 weeks ago. Amazing result, even early on, it's noticeable.
But I just want to be clear, this is still only treating the deep tissues that are causing the skin to be a little lax. You're taking out all of this fat inside the muscle, outside the muscle, but you're still not doing anything to the skin. The skin, you're still letting the skin contract.
No skin removal. No.
Okay, so these are not skin operations.
No, and then for someone that is like, has decent skin tone, but we want to optimize or maximize the amount of contraction that they get, we do FaceTite, which is that radio frequency treatment that I do that heats up the tissues. It maximizes the contraction of the skin without physically removing skin. So then we go into deep plane facelift, which, you know, this has been a podcast of ours in the past. I'm not going to go into super big detail about it. But the deep plane facelift involves releasing all of those ligamentous attachments, not so much in your neck, but in the face, the lower face, in addition to sculpting the neck. That is used when you have skin laxity. So if I look at your neck and I say, yeah, I could remove the fat compartment, but then what are we going to do with the skin? And non-surgical is just not cutting it. You need a neck lift.
Why are you looking at me when you say that?
I'm just talking to you.
Okay.
I'm not looking at your neck, though. In time, I will.
And but wait, I have a question. So I see a lot of patients who go to, they get this beautiful facelift, and their neck has been completely ignored.
Ignored.
So they have a youthful-looking, beautiful, contoured face, and then they have an age-appropriate neck or an unoperated neck. So can you just explain... With a deep plane facelift, does that give you better neck contour than a traditional facelift?
Not necessarily. Deep plane is basically resuspending the tissues in your midface and lower face.
So it doesn't treat the neck?
Not really, because you have to open the neck up. You got to make a tiny incision and you have to address it like that, where you have to sew the muscle, the platysma together. You have to remove the fat. And then you do your skin reductions on around the ears, you know, that are quite nicely designed around
and
the ears.
And so you're treating the deep layer of the neck, but then on this outside to tighten the skin, what are you doing?
What do you mean by that?
So I'm imagining you empty out the neck and you have all of this loose turkey goblet skin.
Yes.
What do you do to...
You're pulling the skin laterally and you're kind of doing vectors that are the natural vectors to restore the natural contours to the face.
But that can all still be done with just an incision around the ear.
It can, but if you're not removing the fat under the neck or you're not sewing the muscles together under the neck, these patients will look good for 3 or 4 months. And as their skin starts to relax,
skin relaxes,
those muscles will start to become apparent again. I see this so often that I can't believe there are so many surgeons out there that don't address the neck with their facelift. And I don't know if it's a factor of time, skill, comfort level. I don't know what it is, but it's very frustrating for me to talk to the patient about this because it means another surgery for them.
Okay, so I'm gonna give you four patients, and I want you to tell me what you would do.
Okay,
30-year-old patient has a double chin, no facial wrinkles or anything like that, just kind of a fat chin. What do you offer them?
Fat chin, 30-year-old, probably submental lipo, but I'd have to feel again. Remember, I'd feel that compartment, and I'd say, is there a big fat pad underneath? I would do some mental lipo and offer them the deep neck sculpting, but some of them are just like, hey, let me see what we can achieve with the lipo, and we'll just do that.
Okay, 60-year-old, very thin female comes in, and she complains of jowling and some excess skin in her neck.
Hands down, deep plane facelift, because those jowls are being formed because of laxity and descent of the fat pads. They need to be resuspended. And then also all that laxity needs to be addressed
by
physically trimming the skin.
65-year-old guy comes in.
Male.
He is pretty obese. So he has a fat neck plus a lot of loose skin.
Okay. Recommend a little... How fat is he?
He's pretty chubby.
Okay. So... be realistic about expectations, because really the answer is lose a little bit of weight to let the face... I say let the face declare itself.
He's been on his Ozempic, so he's lost
some weight. How long has he been on Ozempic? 3 months, and he's going to stay on it? So I would say another deep plane facelift, but really, again, that deep neck sculpting that needs to happen at the same time to clean out that fat compartment, or else he's going to have... still a full neck with maybe a little bit of a better jawline. In order to contour the jawline, you have to remove that fat.
Okay, fourth patient is a 50-year-old woman who has lost 90 pounds. She doesn't have really a lot of fat in her face or her neck at all, but she has a massive amount of skin in her neck.
She needs a neck lift, a deep plane facelift, which includes the neck lift, but also I'd probably end up recommending probably fat grafting for her because she needs volume replacement in her face. She probably looks very gaunt.
So it sounds like deep plane facelift is really what you're doing most of the time now.
A lot of people. Yeah, it's just, it is the best way to restore those fat pads that have not only descended with gravity, but shrunken. And you see beautiful restoration of the mid-face volume. You know how we all get, or we see it, I don't have it yet, but that crease that you start forming, like, I know what it's called medically, but I'm trying to describe, it almost looks like a crease that goes from the corner of your eye to your, like, mid-cheek, like this, like, divot that begins to form.
Like a tear trough?
It's kind of, it's like contiguous with the tear trough. So think of a tear trough, which is like that little depression around the eye, but it kind of keeps going downward. That's a result of your skin falling, but those ligaments are so adherent that they don't let the skin go. So they keep letting it fall, but that it keeps falling without freeing up the ligament.
Right.
So part of the deep plane is freeing up that ligament, which softens all the contours.
Okay, here's another question, because I hear these myths and my patients ask me this all the time. Is there a way to do a facelift with just an incision in front of the ear?
If someone has very minimal laxity along their jawline that is looking for just a little lift with no evidence of excess neck skin and no neck work that needs to be done, yes. I think they're very short-lived and ineffective. And I used to do those mini lifts probably 5 years ago. I still offer them to very select patients. But truly, if you're looking for some type of lift, you end up getting some variation of a deep plane with me.
And then I guess the other question is, can you do a neck lift with just an incision behind the ear?
You can in very isolated instances. I saw somebody this week that had a previous neck lift that has laxity, that would be a great candidate for just an incision with maybe a little bit of the earlobe, extension of the incision around the earlobe. That's it, to remove excess neck skin because the mid-face looked perfect.
Okay, well, I think we all learned something.
I think that's what a lot. I think the takeaway of this is if you're interested in doing some sort of facial rejuvenation, you just need to sit down with us and say, hey, what would the plan be? Or what are my options? Because you have to look at the tissue, you have to pinch it, you have to feel it, you have to see how mobile it is. There's so many things that go into it, because people will call all the time and say, like, can I just do a virtual?
Right.
And I say no a lot of the time, because you know what?
You have to touch the tissue.
You have to touch the tissue. What I see on Zoom a lot of the time doesn't mean much to me.
Yes.
And I can't give you the best recommendation possible.
I feel the same way about the breasts.
Yes. Well, especially for your imaging.
Yeah. So highly individualized treatment plan for each person. A facelift is not just a facelift on everyone. And I think that, you know, one of the things that we see a lot of times is there are surgeons who do the same facelift on every patient, regardless of their weight, their skin laxity. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, where you run into trouble.
It's very frustrating to see that, because a lot of the times they end up wanting a procedure 2-3 years after. And for those that have had a neck lift, they know that this isn't just like an easy bounce back. Oh, I'm back to work in 3 days. It's not horrible, but you have to commit to it. And so to get in your mind that you potentially have to commit to it a second time that soon is very frustrating. So just make sure you get a proper consultation with someone that does these surgeries a lot.
Board certified.
Board certified.
Plastic surgeon, facial plastic surgeon.
That does a lot of facial plastic procedures.
Okay, so we are almost out of time. I know you're absolutely dying to talk about your CO2 laser. We don't have time.
I cannot believe
we don't have time for you today. But if you go to Instagram on SomanicMD, you can see the entire CO2 facial drama. That is all for this week. Have a great week, everybody. We will be back next week.
Bye-bye.
That's a wrap. remember to share the podcast with your friends. Follow the docs on Instagram at SominicMD, at Dr. Troy Pittman, and at DC Dynamic Duo. To learn more about the procedures discussed on today's podcast, visit www.SominicPittmanMD.com. That's www.SominicPittmanMD.com.